U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says the four-page summary that Attorney General William Barr released following a 22-month probe into alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election creates more questions than it does answers. The AG's statement recapping an exhaustive investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller reports no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, but left open the question of obstruction of justice, which the AG says he will not prosecute. Durbin said during a weekend visit to Illinois State University before Barr released his summary, the Senate Judiciary Committee on which he serves should be among the first to see the entire Mueller report. He tells GLT's Eric Stock, it's still not clear how much of the report the Attorney General intends to eventually make public.
We're hoping that it's a complete report. I think all of the details and all of the evidence that's included in there should be shared with the American people.
And what is Congress prepared to do if they are balking and they are unwilling to make most or all of this public?
Well, it could be an interesting battle because the limitations on the release of this report are strictly the regulations of the Department of Justice. They are not the law of the land. So I don't think there's ever been a court contest. If we demand the complete report so the American people can see it, all of it, it'll be a case of first impression in the courts.
And of course, we don't know what's in the report. Do you feel that the special prosecutor could have pressed harder for the president to have a sit-down interview under oath rather than providing written statements?
Well, I don't know, but I'll say this. I have said from the beginning, I have confidence in Bob Mueller. I've known him for years. I met him right after the 9/11 attack on this country, and he headed up the FBI. I really respect him, and I respect the way he's handled this process. The president has been sending out a tweet tearing him apart almost every single day. He has never stooped to that level. He's done his job professionally, and I stand behind his integrity. I may not agree with every detail of his report, but I'm going to accept it as a professional work product.
And if this shows that there was no collusion with Russia, which, of course, was the whole point of this report, does this give Republicans who have been somewhat fractured over this a chance to unite and say that this is all prosecutorial overreach?
Well, perhaps they will, but let's get down to the bottom line. We know the Russians were trying to impact the outcome of that election when President Trump was elected. We know it because Illinois was the first victim. It was the Illinois voter file that the Russians first invaded. Thank goodness they didn't do any damage to it, but we know it happened. We've got proof that it happened, and it happened in states across the nation. So the Russian involvement efforts, I should say at least, in that election are well documented. In terms of the involvement of the Trump campaign, all we know at this point in the most general way is that Mueller concluded there wasn't enough evidence to convict anyone for wrongdoing. I don't know what he did find. I wish we could see the entire report so we'd know more.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi essentially took impeachment off the table unless there was something overwhelming that would lead to bipartisan support for that. Did she speak too soon, perhaps?
No, I think she did. She spoke just in time in light of the Mueller release of his report. Keep in mind the mathematics of impeachment. A majority in the House of Representatives can impeach a president, but the trial for impeachment is in the Senate. It takes 67 of the 100 senators to vote for impeachment. At that point, you clearly need a strong bipartisan majority for the Constitution to be invoked in this situation. So I think Nancy Pelosi was right. We have a lot of work to do. The American people want us to roll up our sleeves and tackle issues like health care, the cost of health care, the cost of prescription drugs, what we're going to do with student loans that our children are facing in the future. There are many things. Infrastructure. Here I am at a laborers meeting here celebrating the 100th anniversary of Local 362. Their question to me is, Senator, when are we going to start rebuilding America? We got roads and bridges and things that need to be done. I think Nancy Pelosi was right to remind us those are our priorities.
That seemed to be one thing that had universal support, at least at the start of the Trump administration. How has nothing gotten done?
Well, the president promised it. He said there would be infrastructure. Then he came up with what I consider to be a non-starter. He said, well, we'll do this differently. Instead of 80% federal money and 20% local, it'll be 80% local, 20% federal. That isn't going to happen. Take a look at Illinois. You know, we're going to borrow some money for a capital bill, but it isn't nearly what we need across our state. We need a federal commitment so that you can take the part that's state and local and build on it dramatically to turn our economy forward.
The town of Normal here has sought funding for an underpass at Uptown Station. Congress, of course, supplied money for the creation of Uptown Station about a decade ago. Is there hope for them in the future?
I think there is. And I hope first that the state legislators will make this a priority for the capital bill that may come out of Springfield, number one. And number two, I hope that we, on a bipartisan basis, can come together for infrastructure. If there's one thing both parties ought to agree on, it's building the infrastructure of America is essential. Our competitors around the world are investing, China, for example, in infrastructure for the 21st century. We cannot be left behind.
If I may shift for a moment, Senator Durbin, to foreign affairs, and the president a few days ago announcing that the U.S. would respect Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights. Does that set a concerning precedent?
Absolutely, and I can tell you why. First, I am committed to Israel's security. I won't back off of that, and I can show a voting record of many years in support of that concept. But I am also committed to a two-state solution, which has been the American foreign policy when it comes to Israel and the Palestinians for decades. That two-state solution means that both the Israelis and the Palestinians will have a safe, sovereign state. You can't have that happen if the Israelis continue through Netanyahu to grab territory that might create part of a Palestinian homeland. There's got to be an option available to them. The alternative, sadly, is Israel would be much different in the future. If it is only one state, then frankly they'll not be able to call it either a Jewish state or a democracy at that point.
Was this perhaps an effort to protect an embattled president in Netanyahu?
Netanyahu is hanging on by his fingernails. He is facing indictment himself. His coalition fell apart. He's reached out to the most extreme members of the Israeli Knesset, one party that they characterize as the Ku Klux Klan of Israel. This Meir Kahane's party is one that he's brought into his coalition. He's been roundly criticized by American Jewish community for doing that, and the president, I think, is trying to come to his rescue.
As we stand here with the Illinois State University campus, the Trump administration a couple of days ago essentially put colleges and universities on notice that if there was any restriction of free speech, as they define it, that those schools could be losing out on research grants. Does that raise any concern for you?
That is a frightening prospect, to think that this administration and Donald Trump will stand in judgment on decisions made by individual universities as to whether they're going to have speakers on campus. And if they don't meet the president's approval, he's going to cancel the medical research projects at the university. That is an awful prospect. It goes way beyond what any president should aspire to do.
They have seemed to indicate that their concern is that some places, some universities have limited conservatives and religious speakers from coming on campus, or perhaps shamed them into speaking, and that it's too one-sided in many places.
Well, I don't see it that way, but I will say this. I stand for the basic principle that our Bill of Rights, in particular our freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, are essential to being part of America. And university campuses, as much if not more than any other venue, should prove that every day by bringing in diverse speakers across the political spectrum so that those in the audience and the students really do see both sides of the story. Now, there are moments, let's make sure we understand this, where a controversial speaker may cross the line and incite violence. And it could be a dangerous situation which each university has to measure. But in terms of diversity of thought and diversity of expression, I support it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. You've questioned the FAA this week about the safety of the Boeing 737. Can the American people be confident that the FAA is doing everything it can to ensure safe travel in our airways?
Unfortunately, in the first 2 years of his administration, the president did not fill that slot, the head of the Federal Aviation Administration. That, unfortunately, left a vacancy or a void where we needed safety the most. And now we're faced with this Boeing crisis. I wish the FAA had its leader and was up to speed from the beginning. But now let's look at the situation. The president finally came to the position that he was going to ground the aircraft as other nations had called for. Boeing is in the process of evaluating the reason for these two deadly crashes. Some of the information that's coming out is troubling, that safety devices were optional on some of these planes. That, to me, is hard to believe, that that's an option as to whether you'll have a safety device. It's a time for leadership and regulation, doing it the right way so that we all have confidence in all the airplanes we fly in.
And lastly, as we look ahead to 2020, we're hearing word that Joe Biden, a long longtime colleague of yours may be entering the 2020 race for the White House. Given that the Bernie Sanders camp in 2016 had claimed that the Democratic establishment, including the superdelegates of which you were one, had sort of squeezed them out for the candidate that the party felt was the safer pick, had a better chance of winning, is there concern that if a similar scenario happens again, that a lot of the energy that is coming into the party on the progressive wing could feel shut out?
Well, I want to make sure that this party is welcoming to people who share our values, regardless of the candidate they're currently supporting. When it comes to superdelegate status, listen, I can take it or leave it. I'm happy to serve as a superdelegate if it helps the party, but if they believe they want to open those slots for others, I'm perfectly open to that as well.
Will you be supporting any of the Democrats in the primary?
I doubt it. You know, I happen to serve in the U.S. Senate, and I said to one of my colleagues the other day, you see that table of eight senators? Four of them are running for president. So we have quite a few of our colleagues who are in the race. They're all well qualified, and many who aren't senators are well qualified in the race. Let's have this process unfold in Iowa and New Hampshire and other states. At the end of the day, we'll have a nominee, and of course, we know what our goal is in 2020.
That was U.S. Senator Dick Durbin with GLT's Eric Stock. Durbin says several of the presidential hopefuls have sought his support for 2020. He did not say which ones. Durbin visited ISU to help the local chapter of the Labor's International Union celebrate its 100th birthday.